Cunningham for another extraordinary message on Gill Athletics Connections.
All right, here we go. You're back. I'm back. We're all back here on the Gill Athletics Connections podcast. And before I introduce today's guest, I just want to give a quick shout out. If this is your first time or your 100th time, the theme music that we have going on that you just heard, I'm just so grateful for the producer of that, Udon Cheek. He's the assistant coach at Eastern Carolina University. And I'm just so grateful for him doing that for us. You'll hear the full version if you hang out all the way to the end of the podcast. It's the full song that he did, lyrics and all, and really just a super talented guy. And so I always want to give a shout out and just remind people what Udon Cheek did for us. We're just so, so grateful. All right. So today, speaking of grateful, I'm super excited about this. I've known today's guest for a while, done some things here and there with him, and really excited about the university that he represents and the person that he represents. Help me welcome the head coach of Hampton University, the wise, the wonderful Mr. Maurice Pierce. Maurice, how are you, sir?
Good morning. Well, good afternoon.
That's right.
I'm doing fine. I have a busy morning, so I'm always thinking it's still morning time. So other than that, I'm good. I'm blessed. Everything is good.
You know, it's podcast world. You don't know if someone's listening at midnight, 6 a.m.
Yeah.
You just say, good day. How are you today?
Yeah, that's what I'm going to do for now. Just good day. I'm good. Good day to everybody else.
That's exactly it. Well, hey, speaking of busy, thank you. You know, I'm always a grateful for coaches when they agree to be on the show. For one, it's not an easy show to be on, meaning, you know, we're an hour plus. This isn't a 20-minute sit down and be done, and, you know, before you can drink your cup of coffee, you're done with the podcast. This takes some time, so I'm grateful for that. And then I realize, especially during track season, how busy you are. So super grateful for your time and being able to carve out some time for us today. Thank you so much for that.
No doubt. I'm glad that we can, you know, coordinate a time. Yesterday was crazy.
No one sees behind the scenes. It was all perfect. Everything's perfect. We're all good. We all matched up on the same day at the same time. We're good.
Yeah.
We're good.
That was crazy.
Well, Maurice, let's hop into it. I'm super excited to learn more about your journey. You know, along the way, somewhere track and field came into your life. It could have been super early. We've had people that were in track since they were basically born. They were coaches' kids. And we've had people come into track and track coaching super, super late in life, past college. Where does track and field start for you?
Wow. That's you're taking me way back. Track and field started for me in middle school. I think maybe like in the 7th grade or 8th grade, Huntington Middle School, Newport News, Virginia. For whatever reason, and it was a good reason, the Newport News Public Schools decided to have middle school sports. So you're talking about like 1985 or something like that, 86, 85. And they decided to have basketball and track and field. And a couple of my friends got wind of it, and they wanted to be a part of this track team. And I was already a fast kid. Right. I was one of those kids that can outrun everybody in the neighborhood or challenge everybody. At least I thought. But I was a fast kid. And we had some phenomenal fast kids at the middle school that I was going to. Right. And so everybody would like line up and for the physical fitness award and run the 55-meter dash. And they line up the fastest kids in the building, whether you were a 6th grade, 7th grade or 8th grade. And so that was my introduction to track because I really wasn't a track person. I played rec league football, and at least I thought I was a basketball player playing rec league. but because I was already a fast kid, it really never dawned on me to like run track. I always looked at track as something for people that weren't fast and that needed to get fast.
Oh, interesting. Now, that's actually a really interesting kind of comment to make now, knowing you're a coach who makes fast people faster. That's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. So it really like, you know, in Newport News, you know, it got phenomenal athletes in Newport News. And, you know, I never really knew about a club or anything like that. You know, my mother, she wasn't having all that. That cost money. So, you know, I was already a fast kid and I told him, I said, look, man, you know, track, like for people that's trying to run fast. They're like, nah, man, you don't get it. We're going to have a track team for real. So I said, oh, okay. All right, well, when we practice, sign up. Let's start it. Let's get ready. Then after that, you know, I was hooked on track after that.
Is that right?
Yeah, and it wasn't long because we only ran for like a couple of months.
Right.
Then you go back to doing your regular stuff as teenagers do. And then, you know, when I got in the eighth grade, I ended up having to run for the high school in the eighth grade. Right, for the JV team at the high school and all that stuff. And then I started back playing football at high school. So track started, like, it was just on a wing and a prayer that they was going to see if it was going to work with the middle school sports.
So I'm not hearing you grew up watching the Olympics. So you didn't know any track people. This was just like, all right, well, we're going to do a sport. It's basketball or track. I guess I'll try track.
Yeah, see, the problem, to answer your question, like, I know a lot of fast guys. Like, around here in Virginia, it was, you know, phenomenal track people historically.
Absolutely.
Historically. So I always knew of the great track athletes in Newport News or Hampton.
Okay.
You know, older guys that, you know, were probably like my coaches that ran like in the 60s and 70s and early 80s. So I always knew the history of those guys. So I didn't really have to like have a big broad view of, like, I knew the history of the Olympics and the people that ran in the Olympics.
Right.
Right. But it didn't dawn on me at an early age because I didn't know anything about club track. Club track wasn't a big thing in our area. And so I was like, you know what? I'll just wait till I get to high school. And then when I get to high school, right, then I can just, you know, run track along with playing football. So that's how it was. Like I had a conscience and I knew about track and the Olympics and things like that.
Right.
But it was just, like I said, a matter of like, there was no clubs going on around here.
Yeah.
It's
interesting. I'm visioning, you know, what you're going through there as a seventh and eighth grader. And I'm actually living that out right now as I have a seventh grader who did track last year as a sixth grader. You know, obviously he's been around track, you know, he's my son. So, you know, he's, you know, knows people and met people and things like that, but he still doesn't know track. You know, I'm not coaching. So, you know, we're not going to meets every weekend, things like that. And he's, you know, and it was interesting. The thing that kind of stood out to me the most, exactly what you said there, you know, middle school track, they do it for like 2 months and then they go back to their other stuff. Like he was doing Scholastic Bowl and other stuff. And then he's just starting track now and it'll be like almost tomorrow, basically. He'll be done and that's it. See you next year. And it's like, wow, really? That's just so short. I mean, they're middle schoolers, so it makes sense. But it did strike me that of just like,
I think it was like dabble. Back then, I think it was an experiment to see if it was the middle school sports was going to work.
Right.
And it worked for a small period of time. It worked for a small period of time, and then they got rid of the middle school sports.
Oh. Well, do you know why they did that?
Yeah, at that point, like I said, they transitioned to try the middle school sports, and then when I got to high school, you know, after a couple of years, they didn't hear about the middle school sports anymore. So I think they either lost some funding through the school system. Matter of fact, they just brought middle school sports back to Newport News last year.
Oh, wow.
So you're talking about a long time, right? So I just think it was something that came through. They started it, and it was exciting, and then it just fell to the wayside.
Yeah. So you go on to high school and you go back to, are you doing football and track combo then at that point?
Yeah. Yeah. My whole life, that's all I knew. You play football in the fall, you play like rec league basketball in the winter, regardless if you're good or not, you play. Right. And you play baseball in the spring and you do whatever in the summer.
Right.
So when I got to high school, you know, you got to concentrate now. So in high school, it was football in the fall, and then indoor track and outdoor track. And then, you know, summertime, you just hang out or whatever. But I was just locked in with two sports. So that was always my routine or the pattern of the year. And everybody in my neighborhood, either, you know, they played football or they played basketball and some ran track. So it was like the norm. And if you didn't do anything, people looked at you kind of strange.
Yeah, you got in trouble, typically.
Yeah, like, you don't do anything?
Right. So you mentioned you were fast, or at least thought you were one of the fast kids in the neighborhood. How did you find your events? Did you get into sprints? Did you hurdle, jump? What did you end up actually being as an athlete?
Well, automatically, you know, I just said, I'm going to live in the fast lane. So I'm going to do whatever. if it's fast, I'm going to do it. You know, my DNA, my body ain't set up for like long distance running.
Amen.
Like that. All right. So, you know, after about a mile, that's it. So I just think genetically, it was already in me to be a sprinter. Right. So I didn't, you know, I was too short to be a hurdler. So not just straight speed. And that was it.
Do you remember your high school coaches and how they interacted with you as coaching?
Yeah, when I was in high school I went to Warwick High School in Newport News, Virginia. And we had some phenomenal coaches there. And I had some phenomenal athletes that I had to, you know, the opportunity to run with and to look up to. My track coach was a guy named John Quillen. He had a phenomenal staff. He just was a phenomenal track coach and his whole staff.
When you describe, typically when we hear the way you describe Coach Quillen as, you know, tough and disciplined, and we talk about the workouts, you know, you talked about he was really good at working with jumpers, knowing what you had to run to hit certain times. Did that extend to off the track? Like, was he a tough, disciplined coach in regards to, Maurice, make sure you're in class, make sure you're getting good grades, make sure you're, you know, not out getting in trouble? Was he, I kind of call it the holistic coaching, or was he more focused on the track with you?
Oh, no, Coach Quillen didn't play any games. And Coach Quillen was also he was a health and physical education teacher. So you had to be in his class anyway. And he was a no-nonsense guy in terms of how you act, your behavior, your grades, going to class, all that stuff. So he wasn't just locked into the athletic side. I mean, he was locked in to you as a person. And I had the opportunity to be there with him for 2 years, because then he left to take another head football coaching job.
Oh,
but he instilled discipline in everything that you did.
He obviously had an impact on you, and what you just described there, that can be tough, especially we're talking about at this age, probably in a 16, 17 year old age. So you get a whole new track coach going into your last couple of years.
Yeah, what happened was Coach Quillen was the head coach, but he was also at the football coach at Hampton University.
Oh.
Yeah, so he was assistant football coach at Hampton University when I got to high school. And so he wanted to be a head high school football coach, and so he took another head job in the same city in Newport News. And the staff that he had, the staff members just took over the program. A lady named Miss Delma Danley, who's my second mom, she became the head coach, right? And she took care of me for the next 2 years. Really, she took care of me my whole life, to put it like that, because I've known her since I was in middle school. But she took over, and we didn't miss a beat. You know, they just transitioned Miss Danley to the head coach and kept the same staff.
Now, you had mentioned earlier that Coach Quillen was kind of the, this is my word, I'm not putting words in your mouth, the hard ass. He was the tough, disciplined guy. And you said the staff was kind of the laid back. They kind of were able to take the heat off a little bit. So did you have two different kind of styles in high school? Did you have Coach Quillen for a couple of years of the strict disciplinarian, and then Thelma, Coach Daniels, I don't want to say the opposite, because the opposite is not true, but less than the hard ass discipline?
Well, I don't know if it was so much less than, but Coach Quillen, that was just his demeanor. Coach Quillen was just a tough, no-nonsense guy.
Yeah.
And Miss Danley and Coach Ross and Coach Jackson, Coach Ruffin, I won't say they was kind of like laid back, but their demeanor wasn't the same as Coach Quillen.
It was different.
But they were tough. Right. But they still showed you tough love. Like, right. you still couldn't operate with them with a whole lot of foolishness.
Right.
And Miss Danley, she could get on you. She'd be tough on you, because you had to go to her class also. At some point, you was in her class, right? So basically, like, Coach Quillen might have been gone, but the same team discipline,
yeah,
and the same caring attitude and the same development was still there.
And I want to make sure I'm saying her last name correctly. Danley, not Daniels.
Yes, Danley.
Danley. Okay, I think I called her Miss Daniels earlier. Thank you, Coach Danley.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, that's why I didn't want to say, you know, Coach Quillen the hard ass and then Coach Danley the opposite, because that's not true. It's there's different ways of showing tough love, discipline, characteristics as a coach. Yeah. Okay. Good.
Yeah. Like Coach Quillen, like you could just walk up on Coach Quillen and just have like regular conversations and laugh and joke with him. Right. He was straight tough guy at all times. Like you could have sidebar conversations and personal conversations and things like that with the other people, the other staff members, like Miss Danley. You know, she was a nurturer. So she was tough, but she was also a nurturer.
Right. Right. I love that. That's awesome. So as you're going through high school and you have Coach Quillen for a couple of years as the head coach, and then Coach Danley comes in after he takes off for a head high school coaching position, football coaching position. That's pretty cool. What were your thoughts as you're leading up to senior year? And, you know, we start thinking about where am I going to go to college? If I'm going to go to college, am I going to run or not? What was your thought process as you're going into senior year of what might next be for academics and athletics?
Well, you know, my senior year was an interesting year. It was because, you know, right, you get kind of like scared or don't know what's going to happen after your senior year. And so I always had to come up with a plan. And so my plan was like, you know, I was, you know, a poor kid in Newport News. I had to have a plan, right? And so my plan was always a survival plan. And so I had to come up with a plan and figure this thing out my senior year. And because I became like a good track athlete, I had more opportunities in track than football to further the career. And so my senior year, you know, I had to have a heartfelt conversation with myself and just pour all my energy into running, because running was the thing that was going to get me out and start me on my way of the next journey or the next part of my life. You know, like everybody anywhere in America, everybody loves football. Everybody wants to play football. At some point you're going to stop, but everybody's going to play football. Everybody's going to try to play basketball. But it's not enough scholarships to go around in football. And at that point also, you know, I just felt as though it wasn't a whole lot of guys that I grew up with that were phenomenal athletes that were continuing their football career in college. For whatever reason, and I got my own personal reasons, but it just wasn't the success rate or the trajectory of people continuing to play football wasn't there. Right. And so I had to look at the whole big picture. I said, you know what, do I just keep on trying to do both things, or do I just try to put all my energy into one thing and see where it takes me? Right. So I put all my energy into running to open up some more opportunities for me. And so you're right. So my senior year, it was kind of like, you know, Maurice, you got to figure this out. You know, my mother was working hard. She was working two jobs. My brother and sister, they doing different stuff. And so it's just me. I got to figure it out. And so I've always been a guy who always had a plan or tried to have a plan. And so when I look back on it, my plan kind of worked.
So what was the plan? I'm in suspense. So what were you thinking?
my plan was like, you know what? I'm just going to concentrate on running. Uh-huh. And see how far. See if I can, one, if I can get faster.
Right.
Two, I needed to increase my academics. I needed to become better in academics. So I had to take away a whole lot of stuff that wouldn't allow me to concentrate on running or the academic part. Mm-hmm. And so in a real sense, me focusing on it helped me go to school to run track, but I didn't get any faster by just concentrating on track. And later on, what I realized is that when you're 16, 17, 18 years old, when you start trying to like isolate yourself and just concentrate on one sport, most of the time it really doesn't work. Mm-hmm. So the better you are as an athlete and the other sport helps the next sport,
right,
then that's how you do it. But for me, I had to have a plan. And so that was the only way. And the people I talked to said that I could work this plan of getting opportunity to go to college, and which it did. But like I said, I didn't run any faster, but I was able to compartmentalize and put stuff in perspective.
I like how you learned that lesson though as an 18-year-old. Those are tough lessons to learn as 38-year-olds. You know, when you're 18, that's the time to make mistakes and to find out something isn't working or does work for you. So that's, you know, it seems devastating as an 18-year-old. Like I did all this work for track and I'm not getting faster. I'm sure that felt like the end of the world. Like, what is happening here? But again, do it as an 18-year-old, not as a 38-year-old. So that's good.
Yeah, because I was disappointed because when I look back on it, because you got to realize, like, I played football as a kid. Then I played football in high school. But my senior year, right, I put all my eggs into one thing, which was track. And like I said, I didn't run any faster, but my perspective and the things that I had leading up for my future opportunities were in place. But if I had to do it all over again, I probably would have just found a way to just, you know, still do all the sports,
right,
and probably just, you know, cut out some social life stuff.
Right. Yeah. So. That's usually the key to it. Yeah. We look back now, it's like, you know, what I probably should have just done is not done that part.
Yeah. You know, but it was scary though, because like I said, I'm homegrown. I'm a Newport News guy. And I'm a Hampton guy too. I went to elementary school for a couple of years in Hampton. And like I said, the success rate of my friends or older people continuing their football dreams were just wasn't there, right? And so I had some sleepless nights and teary-eyed days deciding on how I'm going to manifest my senior year to get myself into college somewhere.
Right.
And track was the avenue to that. The percentage says I got to concentrate on track to make it work.
So where did that lead to you? Did you end up going to school, or what happened after senior year?
Yeah, my senior year, I ended up going to Norfolk State University.
Oh, is that where you went to school? Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. I'm a Spartan.
Yeah.
And so I went over there. I went to Norfolk State, and a couple of guys, one of my high school teammates and classmates, he also went there. He went there to play football. Right, a guy named Marlon Hooker, and so we kind of like went there together. Right, he went to play football. I went to run track, and that's how it worked out. You know, we was being recruited. Then one day we say, "Man, what school are you going to?" Right. I said, "I'm gonna go to Norfolk." He said, "Well, I'm gonna go to Norfolk too." And my high school coach, Miss Danley, and Coach Jackson, they were Norfolk State graduates. So, at that time, to me, Norfolk State probably was the best fit. You know, I was recruited by a lot of the HBCUs up and down the East Coast, right? From Morgan State to this institution here, Hampton, North Carolina A&T. Yeah, you name it. It wasn't an HBCU school that hadn't contacted me. Mm-hmm. So you're talking about like 1990. Mm-hmm. And so I had, you know, I could have went to either one of those schools, but Norfolk State was the perfect fit for me because Norfolk State gave me opportunity to grow academically and put things in perspective. And plus, it wasn't too far. I knew a lot of people there. My classmate went there too. I had friends from the other schools in the district that work at Norfolk State or were going to Norfolk State. So I went there with about five people I already knew. And Norfolk State is only about a good 30 minutes from Newport News.
Right.
So, you know, 65% of the people that live in this area are linked to Norfolk State some kind of way, with the other 40 to 50% being linked to Hampton Institute at that time, so Hampton University. So Norfolk was my place.
You know, HBCUs in the last few years have it's kind of becoming, air quotes here, cool. Like there's becoming more branding to it. Certainly, you know, Dion going to Jackson State kind of put more mainstream, maybe mainstream is the right word I should be saying here instead of cool.
Right.
HBCUs have been around for a long, long time. Great, great institutions. Was it special to you to go to an HBCU back then? Like, did it mean something to you? Like, oh, I'm going to an HBCU. Back then, or was it just that's a school and I know what it's an HBCU, that's great, it's gonna, you know, be good for me culturally and academically and athletically, or was it like, oh yeah, no, I'm gonna go to school, I'm going to an HBCU?
Yeah, probably so. Let me tell you why. Because a large percentage of the people that I dealt with in life, whether it be relatives or all my coaches, were HBCU graduates. So 90% of everybody in my walk of life were HBCU graduates. And so then you also got to remember, this is a hotbed in this area for HBCUs. You know, four HBCUs in this state. And then next door, North Carolina, it's like 6 to 8 HBCUs. Then you go to D.C. or Maryland, you got more HBCUs. So this region is populated with HBCUs.
Right.
So that's really like all I knew.
So you kind of had the a culture already of HBCUs and what they were and what they meant.
Yeah, the culture was already in me because as a kid, I used to come over to this institution here, Hampton University, come to football games and basketball games. But like I said, the whole environment that I grew up in and everybody I dealt with were HBCU graduates, right, or they hung out at HBCU. So that's really like, that was my thinking. And then you're talking about the late 80s. So a lot of kids around here were still going to HBCU. It was still the thing to do. It didn't, to maybe like 20 years ago, this boy, the people, kids stopped going to HBCUs. But back then, in the late 80s, early 90s, it was still a floodgate of people, of students and athletes going to HBCUs. Then you got to realize also at that time, a lot of the HBCUs were Division II. Like when I went to Norfolk State, Norfolk State was Division II. We competed in the CIAA. So, you know, Division II, you know, you can always find a home at a Division II school. You know, it's a home. It can always cater to your talent, or you can find your niche somewhere to go to a school at that level.
Yeah, makes sense.
Even though we competed at the highest level, right, like I said, I told everybody I was in the CIAA at that time.
Yeah, makes sense. What did you you decided on Norfolk State for many reasons? What did you think about academically for a profession? Were you going to school to become a teacher, to get a business degree? I don't know. I'm going to study college. What did you go in as an 18-year-old? What did you think going in you were going to become professionally?
Well, really, you know what? My freshman year, I really didn't know what I wanted to do. Hell, I was just excited to be in college. I didn't know. So I'm hanging out with all my boys and everybody got all these majors. And they were like, you know, you don't got to declare no major until like after your sophomore year. I was like, well, that's kind of like too late. The coaches were like, yeah, you got to declare a major. And so my dad was in the hospitality industry, right? And then, you know, the hospitality industry was like a booming career in like the early 90s. You know, the hospitality, whether you went to the business side, whether you went to the restaurant side or whatever, but the hospitality industry was booming. And that's where everybody was getting a job. So there was like a great marketing campaign to get people to major in this the hospitality management, right? And so I went that route because I wanted to go the business route. Like I wanted to own stuff. I said, if I'm gonna work in the hotel industry, I'm gonna own a hotel one day. Or I'm gonna own restaurants one day. So I went the hospitality management route and took extra business classes so I can also have a business background. At that time, you couldn't get a double major, so I just took extra business classes. And I knew I didn't want to major in physical education because that was just too much, too much science and all kind of stuff. So, but I always had a business mind. So I said I could do the business route. And like everybody kept saying, like, you're an athlete, the hospitality industry is booming. You could be out live in Vegas, you could live in Orlando, you can be in New York. I had big plans to go into this hospitality industry, but on the business side. So that was my thing. So I majored in that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And like I said, my father worked in the hospitality industry in hospitals, but I wanted to go the business route. And then at the same time, Mike, to be honest with you, I said, you know what? I like to take business classes, but they got too many like extra classes, like two or three statistics, all this accounting and math. I said, Jesus, I'll never make it out of school. But, you know, that was my route. And then I had some offers after high after college, because everybody was being recruited to move to Las Vegas or to move to Orlando, where the hospitality industry was booming, and working up in D.C. or up in New York. But then somebody gave me a stopwatch, and I started coaching.
So, okay, I always like to ask this question of, you know, what you thought as an 18-year-old, because, you know, to me, it's still preposterous that we make 18-year-olds, like, choose their whole life at 18 years old, by the way. They don't know what in the world they want to do, and here, pick your major, and you're supposed to do it for the rest of your life. That's still just kind of crazy to me. But, and typically, most coaches, typically, don't go into physical education or biology or whatever because they know they want to be a track coach. It usually grows into it. So I'm always, you know, interested in, you know, what you thought you were going to be. And then how did it actually switch? Because obviously you're on the show because you're a track coach. So you say at some point someone gave you a stopwatch and said, all right, well, you're going to be a coach or you're going to coach. How did that happen? What was the, tell me about that.
Well, it kind of like happened off default because I messed up a whole lot of stuff.
Okay.
Like when I got to Norfolk State, you know, it was like I said, it was the right place for me. But at some point in time, I wavered off and started socializing too much, and messed up running. So after 2 years, I couldn't run anymore, right? Because I kind of like I tell everybody I'm so successful as a coach because I screwed up the athletic part.
I made all the mistakes.
Yeah. You know, and so after the 2 years of in and out of running, and you can't run this year, and my reason got this issue going on, my last year at Norfolk State, Coach Laverne Sweat, who was the women's coach at the time, like, she needed some help, right? She had one assistant coach. And at the same time, I needed some help to see how I'm going to finance and pay this senior year in school because I don't have a scholarship, mm-hmm. right? And back then they didn't have what they called fifth year scholarship aid, mm-hmm. right? So you got to figure it out on your own for that fifth if you got an extra year to finish school. And so Coach Sweat gave me a stopwatch and she said, "Come help me at the track." So I became a student assistant, right? And Coach Sweat helped me financially. I mean, she knew somebody in the financial aid office, and I don't know what they did. But my bill was taken care of, and so I helped her. She helped me, and that was my road to coaching. And then I was locked in all the time. I always had the mentality that I was going to be a coach, but I just didn't want to go the physical education route because I know that wasn't me. But I always had a coaching DNA inside of me, mm-hmm. even when I was young at practices and things like that. I used to drive people crazy at practice when I was young.
How
telling
so?
Them what to do.
Yeah, give me an example of that. Yeah.
You know, I used to get on all my friends. If they weren't training hard enough, you know, instead of the coach getting on them, I get on them. Hmm. And they'd be like, "Man, we friends. What are you talking about?" So I said, "Man, no, y'all got to run."
Yeah.
All right. So I was always like the little, like, the guy telling people what to do at practice and getting on people and things like that. And they'd be like, "Man, he think he a coach." So this was when I was like 16, 17 years old. Huh. All my friends, I already knew it was already in me.
Right.
It just came out of me by default.
Let's talk about that. Because what you're describing there is really leadership. You know, having tough conversations with others is a part of leadership. You know, you're 16, 17 years old. You're the same age as them. You hopefully were also, because you were as an athlete on the same team with them, leading by example as well. So if you're telling them, "Hey, you need to try harder," you I hope were also obviously trying hard as well. But there has to be, in my opinion, my experience, you know, we're 250, this is episode 254. So I have interviewed 253 plus coaches. Typically, right. That is a learned behavior. It's a behavior that you have experienced. So it's a model. That's the word I'm looking for. It's a modeled behavior. Where did that come from? Did you see family members, church members, friends, where somewhere that had to be modeled where you're like, you know, that's the right thing to do is to be a leader, to have tough conversations with my peers that they need to try harder.
Right. Probably when I started playing sports, Because you got to realize, like my mother, you know, she worked hard, right? And she was tough. So I had to always lean on coaches to guide me and put me on the right track and make sure I don't fall off that track. So I guess it was already in me because I looked at the coaches as great leaders, and I had great coaches who weren't like, I just had no fly-by-night coaches. Like I had great coaches who all genuinely had great leadership skills. And they took me under their wing as a young person when I was in middle school, and they just kept me under their wing. So I guess that just like fed into me and got ingrained in my DNA, and I started liking it. I said, this leadership stuff is good. So, and then they started like, they would trust me to like do the workouts and like get the team ready and things like that. So I guess because I was forced to be surrounded by coaches who were great coaches, like I said, it was just in me. Cause I was, also what I was doing was trying to like mimicking the coaches. Right. Right. So, and I always been myself. Like I never tried to be nothing like different from nobody else.
Right.
Maurice Pierce always been Maurice Pierce. Right. So I never tried to be no different type of person from even when I was a teenager to when I was a young adult to even grown now. Right. And because of that, you know, I started taking a liking and it started feeding on me that leadership is in me. Because the people that raised me were great, great leaders.
Right. Yeah.
So I said, let me.
I love that it manifested through your high school and college career, your college academic career of like, I'm going to go into hospitality. And then even so when Coach Sweat gave you a stopwatch to help the team, to start helping the team, because those are positive ways that leadership could be there. You know, we do forget sometimes that bad people are also leaders, meaning, you know, gang members, drug dealers, thieves, those are leaders as well. They're bad leaders. They're leading people down bad paths and they're leading themselves down bad paths. But I'm glad that your leadership took a positive turn of like, okay, it's leadership, not just about me. It's about helping others.
Right. Cause I was like people, like I said before, I've always had people to take care of me. I've been extremely blessed in my life that family, friends, coaches always took a liking to me. And they've always taken care of me, probably because, you know, I had a good job of, I would listen. You know, I was the best kid. I was, you know, I'm not no, Maurice Pierce is not a saint. But I always, always listened. And I knew when not to go left, you know, just to stay right. And I think at some point also because I spent much time with coaches that knew that like because of certain environments that I grew up in, the kids can get caught up in stuff real quick. And I think they knew that like I got to keep Maurice with me more than the normal kid, right? One, I needed it, but two, just to protect me, to keep me on the right track, you know, to be successful. And so that just, like I said, it's always like probably it was ingrained in me. And so that's how, you know, I became an effective coach and an effective leader.
Thank God for other people. You know, you got, sometimes we have to sit back and think about that. It's like, oh man, thank God that person stuck with me. Thank God that person was harder on me than maybe they could have or should have been. Thank God for other people. If it was left to just to ourselves, I think we'd be in a lot of trouble.
Oh yeah, major trouble. If I had to make my own choices, right? You know, because you can make bad choices easy.
Easy.
Right. Easy. And then sometimes you don't realize you're like, oh, I made a bad choice, and then it's like kind of like too late. And the people aren't bad people,
right?
Like everybody I grew up with were great guys. Oh my, home, we still friends today. Some of them just, you know, made some bad choices.
Yep.
But we're still great friends because they were great people.
Yep.
They just, you know, made some bad choices, but we're good now.
Yep. That's exactly right. Okay. Laverne Sweat needed help on the women's team. You needed help financially, yeah, and even got a little bit of guidance help as well. Maybe wouldn't have described it as that time, but now looking back, it's like, I need some guidance too. She either actually or proverbially hands you the stopwatch. Okay, you're christened. You are now coach. How did that feel? Yeah. It's different being an athlete, no matter how ingrained you were as an athlete, no matter how much, you know, you paid attention to coaches and what the workouts were and things like that, you're still athlete. You're still being told, Maurice, go run this, go lift that, etc. Now you flip it and you've got to guide young people to run this, lift that, throw that, etc. Do you remember that experience of that first time, or what was maybe a better way of asking that is, what is your first memory of, okay, I'm a coach, I'm running workouts, I'm either timing or I'm actually coming up with a workout? Do you remember your kind of earliest memory experience of that?
Yeah, what happened was Coach Sweat was busy. Like Coach Sweat, she was the head track coach, and Coach Sweat was also the compliance coordinator at Norfolk State at the time. So Coach Sweat was extremely busy. And so, like, Coach Sweat would give me the workout. And she's like, Maurice, I'm not going to be the track, or I'll be the track late. Here go the workout. That's what I want. That's what I want them to do.
Did that make you nervous? I mean, that's a big responsibility on your own going out.
Well, no, not really. It's like, it kind of like got me excited, right? Because I'm telling you, this DNA, this coaching thing started really like kicking in. So I'm getting excited, right? Mm-hmm. And so she was like, this is the workout I want to do. And at that point, I was like, you know what, I'm following Coach Sweat lead, whatever Coach Sweat say, that's the law. But what happened was, the young ladies that was on the team when I first started coaching as a student assistant, they were on the track. It was on the team when I was on the men's team, mm-hmm. probably about 1 year. Mm-hmm. And so we were still like friends. I wasn't Coach Pierce. I was still Maurice. Mm-hmm. Right, so I had to like, and then they be like, we don't want to do this workout. I said, well, that's what Coach Sweat said. We got to do what we got to do. And then I started, you know, talking to Coach Sweat more about changing some things. And she decided, you know, to give me a little more leeway into like changing some of the workouts and catering more stuff to like individuals instead of like the group. And I had a long talk with the men's track coach at that time, Steve Riddick. I don't know if you know Steve Riddick, Olympian.
I was going to say Steve Riddick, the quarter mile, 200.
The sprinter.
So I say when you said that, I was like, there can't be that many Steve Riddicks in track. Jamaican?
No, he's from Newport News. He had a Newport News guy.
Of course, he was Newport News. Of course, okay.
And he went to Norfolk State. But my last 2 years, he came back to Norfolk and became the men's track coach.
Oh wow.
Right, and he gave me opportunity to run indoor track. The last time I could run indoor track for him, and then like I said, I started coaching. As I would lean on Coach Riddick, but Coach Riddick was extremely. He had competed at the highest level in track and field. He got Olympic gold medal, and so I would lean on Coach Riddick. And then Coach Riddick had all these world class athletes that was training in North State at the time, who were friends of mine. Right, we brought these guys in. You know, like, and so I always had a term of reference of like guys, what workouts guys were doing, where they came from.
Right.
So we had some transfers come in, you know, Jamaicans came in there with their workouts, and we had people from African countries coming with their workouts. Hmm. So it was like a professional library to me. I had access to everybody. Right?
That's interesting.
So I would just sit in. Yeah. So I would just sit down and we just brainstorm and talk about stuff. And then I would just bring it back to Coach Sweat. And me and Coach Sweat discussed it. And Coach Sweat said, yeah, we could do this. We ain't going to do that. And like, she'd cut and paste it and do well, but I still got to listen to her. And so it worked out, right? So I was blessed to be in an environment with Steve Riddick, and two, we had all these world-class athletes there.
Yeah.
And with Coach Sweat coached for a long time. So she was extremely book knowledgeable of the sport.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? So I could pull on all things and, like I said, give her – you know, advice. And then she just got real comfortable. Said, Maurice, you got it. You know, as long as I told her what we was going to do and we would discuss everything, and I didn't try to like hide anything or be secretive about anything with Coach Sweat. And then whatever she said that I needed to change, we changed it. I mean, that's Coach Sweat program. She's looking out for me.
Right. Yeah. So two things to unpack there. One thing I'm always fascinated with, typically it's an athlete that becomes a GA at the same program. So I always ask the question like this. I usually say, hey, so, you know, on Friday, you're hanging out with your boys, you're playing Xbox in the dorm. And then on Monday, you're now Coach Pierce. So the similar right. Didn't happen, you know, undergraduate grad here, but you know, basically you're an yeah. athlete, you're a homeboy on the team, you guys are playing, well, you know, back then we were probably playing Atari, right? I'm gonna age you there a little
yeah,
bit.
Yeah.
But you know, you're hanging out, you play, you know, you're talking, you know, it's 20 something year olds in college, and then mm-hmm. again the proverbial, you know, handing off of the stopwatch, now you're running workouts, and I mean, you said it perfect, I love it, now you're Coach Pierce. How did you, that's a different response, that's a different relationship. How did that, you kind of started touching on it, you know, some of the kids be like, hey, Maurice, man, come on, man. These quarters or whatever. How did you handle that?
The girls was like,
yeah.
The girls was like on the team, like, we're not doing that. That's too much running. It was crazy.
Yeah.
So it was a lot of fussing and pulling teeth and arguments at 3:30.
I honestly, your situation's obviously a little bit different, but I honestly think there should be like a rule, all sports, by the way, that if you were an undergrad athlete, you cannot GA at that school. You have to go to another school. Cause then you have a complete right. separation, even though you're still the same age, you know, you're 21, 22 or whatever, when you graduate, you're going to go help coach other 18 to 20 year olds. But at the same school, that flip of that responsibility, that's tough.
But you know what? When I started it though, when I started this coaching thing, even as a student assistant, I was locked in. Because at that point, I put my survival hat on again.
Mm.
And we said earlier, I always got that mm-hmm. survival hat. I got to survive this thing. Mm-hmm. So I said, you know what? I'm on my survival mode right now, and this track thing now, this athletic stuff is behind me. I got to figure out a way. I like this coaching thing.
So sorry to interrupt you. This is another thing I see a lot of times. So you, it sounds like you were able to understand the athletic side is done. A lot of times we don't want to give up that athletic side, right? That becomes our identity. I'm a sprinter. I can coach one day, but you know, how do I run post-collegiately then? Or how do I keep training? You sound like you kind of like, or understand like, hey, all right, this train's gone. I'd love for it to keep going, but it's not. So I need to survive.
Yeah. You know, I figured it out. I said, well, you know what? If I can't run the Olympics, I could train somebody to run the Olympics.
Mm.
Right. So again, I was already a good athlete, even though I screwed up some college stuff. Mm. So I wasn't worried about it. Like a lot of people keep on running or chasing a dream because either they got some hangups or they got some unfinished business or they just, you know, their reputation is.
I wish more people would understand exactly what you just said. Another way to put that, here's how I would say that. Sometimes people continue to run, and we're saying running, by the way, just add track and field, throw, jump,
right.
Add other sports, by the way. You've seen people try to chase this NFL dream way past when they should have.
Yeah.
I think you're exactly right. I think they're running from something. They think they're running towards something. And I think they're running away from stuff. I've never heard it put as well as you put it, Maurice. You have a really good understanding of this.
Yeah, they're running away from it, and they're scared of reality. But for me, I was like, listen, everybody know me, right? They know what I could do. They know my past. But if I try to keep doing that, I'm going to miss out on some more opportunities in front of me. And like I said, when I got that stopwatch, I was like, you know, that was my lottery ticket. So
I like that.
I liked it. I'm gonna make it work. And again, you know, I just thought, you know what? Wow, this is crazy. I'm gonna figure this out. If I can't get to the Olympic Games, I'm going to coach somebody in the Olympic Games and get the same glory. Right? Again, like I said, I always had a plan, like when I was a kid. So that just was my next plan. And I said, my plan is to be a track coach. I'm locked in. I'm hooked in. I ain't turning back. So, you know, I got focused on that part, becoming a better coach. Couldn't hang out as much. I started hanging out with the older coaches just to learn from them. And whatever the sport was, I would hang out with the football coaches at Norfolk State, the basketball coaches. I just wanted to continue to hang around with coaches to become a better coach.
So let's explore that, because I told you there was 2 points. That was my second point. You, and it seems like you almost, you just answered the question I want to ask here. You mentioned about, you know, with Coach Riddick there, you know, you still have Coach Sweat there too. You mentioned she coached for a long time, so she's got a lot of knowledge and experience. You have a lot of pros coaching there, training there, and so you get to see their workouts, to see other country athletes there. You're in a pretty, I mean, that's a pretty unique spot at the age and stage that you are in the coaching career. You're really, you know, if we talk about your coaching career in like the 100 meter dash, you're not even in the set position. You're just now like, okay, getting the blocks. Like you're real early.
Right.
And you've got this really unique, like a lot of people to talk to and get mentored by and ask a lot of questions and listen a lot. You talked about, you know, you're a good listener. Did you realize in the moment, sometimes we don't realize things till, you know, 20 years later, like, oh my God, I can't believe what a magical time, you know, I had at that point. Did you realize then what kind of a unique and special opportunity you had? Or was this still, you know, you could be forgiven that you're like, man, I'm still just in survival mode. I'm just trying to figure out how to become a coach so I can keep moving on with my life positively.
No, I figured it out. I said to myself, I said, you know what? It's probably the greatest on hands track and field library at my disposal.
No doubt.
World-class coaches, world-class athletes, right there with me all day long. And I helped recruit some of these world-class athletes to Norfolk State.
Yeah.
And so you're talking about a training environment where we had, and it was my boys, Tim Montgomery, Andre Kayson was there training, Ramon Clay, Brian Lewis, Chandra Stirrup. You know, you're talking about guys from, Ozzie Zakari from Ghana. Man, you're talking about the best sprinters in the, it was like it could be an Olympic trials at track practice. Yeah. And so, you know, they're my boys, you know.
Wow.
So I was just in the environment, right? So I was still at the age where I could hang out with Ramon Clay and them, my boys, but still put my coaching hat on to coach the ladies.
Right.
All right. So I found that balance. And these guys, they know, they were my boy. They was all in with track. They was on their verge to being great professional track athletes. And, you know, and Andre Kayson was like a couple of years removed from breaking the world record.
One of my favorite all-time sprinters, by the way. Loved him. He's the guy that I use as example. You know, we don't talk X's and O's, so I'll be brief on this. When people talk about acceleration ladders, and I go, hey, you know, Andre Kayson and Usain Bolt both ran 10 flat and better, obviously. But, you know, both of them ran 10 flat at one point in their career. You're going to tell me Usain Bolt's acceleration pattern is going to look the same as Andre Kayson, who, you know, I don't know how tall Andre was, 5'6", 7'8". He was on the shoulders.
I'm sure I got Andre beat. And I'm 5'6". So I'm like 5'5". I got Dre beat by a little bit. He gonna get mad at me, but I got him by a little
that's
bit.
That's why I didn't want to, you know, I was like, you know, he might be listening. I don't want to, you know, don't come after me, Andre. Nah, you were one of my favorite sprinters growing up. I loved
Andre is my guy, man. Andre, you're right. Andre was accelerating when you realize I wasn't in high school at the same time. Andre is 2 years in front of me.
Okay.
Andre was accelerating when he was 16. That dude can accelerate.
I loved him. So when you tell these stories, I just like try to play the movie in my head. So I think about like when I did USATF level 2 and, you know, we're up till, you know, 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock in the morning in someone's dorm room and you're talking with Kaba and Todd Lane. You're just, you know, we're just, that's where real knowledge is coming from. And so I get the same picture of you and them and, you know, and Coach Riddick and you're just asking questions and, you know, well, what if, did you ever try the, you know, I just think about like this melting pot of just questions and answers and experience. Like it's the way to kind of take all these years of experience together and not just all separate having our experiences. I just can't imagine sitting in that room asking questions and listening and pondering. Has to be so amazing.
Well, you're exactly right, because you got to realize two things. One, and everybody knows about, you know, I guess it was like 1968 or whatever, the original Speed City.
Yeah, San Jose. Yep. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so we had a Speed City in Norfolk State in 1996, leading up to the Atlanta Olympic Games. They had a big article in the newspaper. Norfolk International Training. It's called Speed City. You can pull it up. And it was the the version of the original Speed City in Norfolk, Virginia, at Norfolk State University. Because we had the best sprinters in the world at that time training there, getting ready for the Atlanta Olympic Games. Right? So I was, like I said, I've always been blessed to be in the right environments.
Amazing.
And the one, I've been blessed, and two, people have always taken a liking to me, and three, I've always been focused on whatever I wanted to focus on. So I couldn't ask for or been blessed for a better environment.
I mean, that's better to me than you studying biology or biomechanics. I mean, it's an education that you can't ask for, you can't pay for. You either are lucky or not. I mean, literally, it's almost like a, you know, preparation begets luck. But God bless, thank God you were born in Newport News and grew up there and went to Norfolk and not some other school. You know, I mean, that's quite amazing. So
I think to tell you that, like, everything for me was packed. Every stop in my life was a blessing, and I look back and say, you know what, I was supposed to be there, and that's how I became successful at what I'm doing now.
Yeah, that's amazing. So what was the next step? So you're in this student assistant role. You can't be a student assistant for your entire life. What was next?
Well, then I graduated, and Coach Sweat wanted me to go to grad school. And I told Coach Sweat, I said, Coach Sweat, I'm not going to grad school.
Undergrad was tough enough, man. Yeah.
Listen, I was extremely honest with her and myself.
She was very optimistic.
Yeah, she said, no, Maurice, you got to go to grad school. So I said, all right, I'm going to give this grad school thing a go. So I did grad school.
Okay.
I did it for one semester.
Okay.
And I was like, Coach Sweat.
I was correct in this one, Coach Sweat.
Yeah, Coach Sweat. I raised my hand because I got this one right. Right? I just want to coach. He said, no, Maurice, you need all this other stuff. I said, Coach, I just want to coach.
Yeah.
And so I stopped going to grad school. Later on, I went to grad school here at Hampton. But I stopped going to grad school, and Coach Sweat found me a little job on campus. So I had a little job on campus in the athletic bookstore. I had a little side job doing something in Norfolk for that 1 year out of college.
And are you
the next year?
At this point, are you a track coach, meaning – do you have any like still side eye of like, oh, I could still go in the hospitality industry. That is my undergrad degree. Or is it like, no, I am now fully moving down this path.
Oh, I was totally locked into coaching.
Yeah. So it don't matter what you undergrad now. I'm hooked. I got that stopwatch. It's not coming off my neck.
Yeah. No, I was, only thing better was I probably could have been a rapper. But
oh really?
No, I'm just joking.
Okay, man.
Everybody had rap dreams back then. Everybody wanted to be a rapper.
Well, you know, that's so funny that I let off thanking Udon Cheek for the song for our podcast, and you know that's his jam the whole way. I assume you know Udon.
Yeah. Great guy.
Have to put you. But no, you I was locked together. In. We'll have to put you guys in the studio and get a rap duo, rap group going on here, man.
Yeah. That's the only thing back in the 90s, the 80s and 90s, everybody wanted to be a rapper. They were still chasing this rap dream.
By the way, that's my time frame. I graduated high school in 94. I also wanted to be a rapper, just so you know. Now, I was a Vanilla Ice fan, so I wanted to go that route. But it was everybody. You're right. I agree. Yeah, right.
So, I was like, nah, I'm locked in. Okay. I'm all in coaching. And my friends, they were like, yo, man, all you want to do is coach. Man, I'm locked in. Yeah, I wasn't like hitting the clubs and hanging out, and I was locked in the culture. Right.
That's the true testament. Did you still go to clubs? Right. Oh, then you weren't locked in. Oh yeah, you were done. You were locked in.
Yeah, I was locked in, man. I wasn't making any money, but I was, you know, Coach Sweat figured it out. You know, I had a little job on campus. Mm-hmm. And so I said, I'm gonna make this thing work. And then I did that for a whole nother year. And then the following year, I went to, people don't realize this, but I went to University of Maryland Eastern Shore for 1 year, 1998.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
As a full-time assistant?
Full-time assistant.
Okay. So this is your first.
I had a real paycheck then.
Yeah, that's what I hate to do air quotes, but your first real coaching, like paid coaching job.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Like I said, I started off at Norfolk, but my When I was able to get a W-2 form for coaching.
What are you working towards? I'm just trying to get a W-2. Man.
Yeah, that's it. I'm trying to get a W-2.
Take some taxes. That means I got money.
Yeah. When it said, what's your profession? Assistant track coach. Right. So that was that 1 year at Maryland Eastern Shore. I went up there with a guy named Ron Davis. I was up there for 1 year in 1998.
Hmm. And are you, maybe as you're still growing, but, you know, a lot of times we like to, it's a positive and a negative thing here. So I'm not leading you here. I'm not leading the witness here. I want to know where your mindset is. Are you, I'm going to use the word pigeonholing yourself. Are you a sprint coach or are you trying to be a track coach? Or are you still like, no, I'm going to go very deep. I'm a sprint coach.
What, back then?
Yeah.
Back then I was locked in. I said, no, I'm a sprint coach. That's what sprint. I do. I live right. In the fast lane.
That's what you knew? Right, sprint coach. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. Yeah. And then Ron Davis and also Coach Sweat, they like introduced me to all kind of other stuff. Like, well, you know, you got to be an assistant to help me with cross country. Mm-hmm. I was like, cross country? I don't do cross country.
No fast lane there.
Never in my life even been to a cross country meet. So I had to evolve uh-huh, and then uh-huh. learn other events uh-huh. outside of just, you know, the fast stuff. So everybody wanted to just do the fast stuff.
When you went to Eastern Shore, so now you don't have Coach Sweat there. You're on your own, air quotes there. How comfortable were you immediately going into writing your own work? You know, you're driving your section of that program now at that point. How comfortable did you fall into writing your own workouts, recruiting your own kids, you know, administering, doing what track coaches, there's 1,000 other things track coaches are doing.
Yeah, I was very confident because I went there with a guy named Ron Davis. And Ron mm-hmm. Davis was the assistant coach at Norfolk State for like 2 years. After the 96 Olympics, he brought all these distance runners
okay.
up to Norfolk. So he coached in like Nigeria and Mozambique. He coached in Africa for a long time. And he was a San Jose guy. He was at San Jose back in the 60s. Oh, yeah. Okay. So Ron Davis was extremely knowledgeable of track and field. He coached, what's the guy named Philbert Baye in 1500, like 80 Olympics or something like that.
Okay.
And so Ron was very knowledgeable, but his bread and butter was distance.
Right.
And Ron Davis said, look, man, you already know what you're doing. You can coach the sprinters. You know, just don't mess them up, which I know you ain't gonna mess them up. I gave you a job. Mm-hmm. And so he gave me full authority to just coach the sprints and hurdles. And then, you know, every once in a while, he'll put his two cents in, especially with the 400-meter runners, mm-hmm. because he was a Lee Evans guy. They was teammates. Mm-hmm. He's like, man, you do these Lee Evans workouts. Mm-hmm. I was like, coach, they can't handle this workload, man. They can't. Mm-hmm. 48-second quarter mile, I can't do this type of work.
Right. there's certain people that loom large in our sport, like overs, and Lee Evans is one of those. Lee Evans workouts is a famous, like many a times that's been said. It's like, well, you know, Lee Evans used to do this. We should be doing that.
Yeah.
And it worked for Lee.
No, man. No, man. It didn't work, man. But Ron gave me full authority. Yeah.
And you're with
he
someone
was gone a lot.
And you're with someone you knew and trusted because you knew him from Norfolk. It's not like you're.
Yeah, we became friends.
That's a part that a lot of people don't talk about either when you get a new job is, you know, you're learning the athletes and, you know, how to coach them, but you're also learning a coaching staff. And if you're not the head coach, you're learning the head coach. So at least this is someone you had some familiarity with, a friendship with.
Yeah, because I met Ron when he came up there because Ron had the LaGrange track program down in LaGrange, Georgia.
Oh, yeah.
Prior to the Atlanta Olympics. Mm-hmm. And then a lot of those African athletes didn't want to go back to their various countries. So mm-hmm. they followed Ron up to Norfolk. That's where we had the Norfolk International Training Center. And so he was training them. And me and him became real good friends. Again, that's all he talked about was the African athletes and his time at San Jose. So I became a sponge. I just hang out with Ron all the time. Hmm. And he was an older guy. So I said, well, you know, if I hang out with this old guy, I'm going to get in trouble. So let me go hang out with old Ron Davis, right? And then every athlete that he brought over from African country, you know, I would ride with him to the airport, pick these people up, help them get acclimated on campus and all kind of stuff. So we became friends then. So that when he got the job at Maryland Eastern Shore, He said, hey, man, you need to come be my assistant. So I was like, okay. Is it a real check? Yeah, it's a real check. So I said, all right, count me in when I'm leaving. And so it was good. And I had some phenomenal track athletes at the University of Maryland Eastern Shore because they, you know, historically had a great track program. Hmm. And again, I was blessed to just fall upon some great athletes. And I always felt it in right environments. So that 1 year there was extremely good.
Hmm. Why only 1 year?
Well, Ron left. Hmm. Ron Davis left. At that time, he was kind of like disappointed. Like a lot of HBCUs weren't giving out like long-term contracts. Mm-hmm. You get like a 1 year-to-year contract. And for whatever reason, Ron thought he was going to change the system. and he thought, you know, he was going to use his muscle and get the University of Maryland Eastern Shore to give him a long-term contract, which they didn't. And so he decided to take another job. So really kind of disappointed me because he took the head coaching job at the University of New Orleans at that time. So you're talking about like 19, this is the summer of 99, fall, the spring of 99. So he took the head job at the University of New Orleans. How do you pronounce it? New Orleans.
That's its own debate. So
it's his own debate. Yeah. Right. And so Ron, like, he kind of like didn't like have an opportunity for the coaching staff to go with him there. I think it was a situation where he got the job and he had to keep the people that was there, which I was cool with. But at the same time, I was also disappointed. I'm like, man, you got me up here for a year. And now you're leaving. Right. And you don't have no like plan for the coaching staff. It was me and my man, Eric Logan. And so he didn't have a plan for us. Ron just bolted. I'm gone.
Because you're still young to the industry. You don't know that that's a fairly common occurrence.
Right. Like, yo, man, what are you doing? Mm-hmm. Right. And so I just hung around and we did like the, you know, they interviewed me for the head coaching job. And
wow.
I didn't get it because I think they already had in mind who they wanted, which I was cool with. And they said, well, the person we're going to bring in has more experience than you. I said, well, if they're older than me, then they're supposed to have more experience than me, right? I was, you know, talking reckless back then. Yeah. But I was extremely pissed off.
That was good, right? Self awareness.
Yeah, and so what happened was my newborn blood, and being in Norfolk, those tough cities, that stuff started coming out of me. I was like, nah, let me keep this professional. So let me figure this out. So here we go again. I got to figure out another plan. Yeah. So it was simple for me. I said, I'm going home. Forget all this. I'm going back to Newport News.
Without a job offer.
Yeah. I said, you know what? I'm either going back to live in Norfolk or I'm going home to Newport News. Hmm. And I'm going to figure this out. And I said, you know what? You can always go back home. Right. Mm-hmm. So I go back home to Newport News and I talk to Miss Danley and the people at my old high school. And they're like, yeah, we can get you into school. You know, you can work in the building. You can be assistant track coach. If you want to go back and live your football dreams, you could be an assistant football coach. You could be the in-school suspension instructor. I start calculating. I said, I can get all the little checks in the building. Mm-hmm. Right. And I got a good name in Newport News. So that's what I was locked in with. I was like, I'm done with college. I'm going to keep coaching, but I'm done with college.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm completely flat out done, right? Don't call me. Don't even send me a letter. But I'm all locked into the school. Just because I figured, I said, when I go back to coach high school, I can control my own environment, control my own destiny.
Important question here. Was that your attitude because you're like, okay, I see a more clear path on the high school side, not just coaching track, but you know, I in schools, you could see like the way you put it, I could see all these checks adding up and I can make good money and move forward with my life. Or was your attitude about the college opportunities because there was some bitterness towards how things went down in your first college job?
I was bitter.
Yeah.
I was bitter, and for the first time in a long time, I was an angry young man. Mm-hmm. Like I was like pissed off at the world. I was like, man, you know what? I finally found out what I want to do. this is my passion. And then all of a sudden, this guy just gonna leave.
Yeah, it's hard.
And then and as a college coach, you know, it's just cut and dry. You don't have a job. Mm-hmm. And like they said, well, you know, we'll keep you around for a year and figure out something for you.
Right.
Right. Then you don't want to, then I'm not gonna be a lame duck. I'm always gonna sit around and beg the new coach to keep me as an assistant.
Right.
Nah, that ain't in my DNA.
Right.
So I said, you know what, I could fix this real fast. Mm-hmm. I got love in Newport News. I'm going home. Mm-hmm. And so that's how it happened. And I said, you know, I got a college degree. I'm gonna get into the school system and I'm just gonna be phenomenal high school coach. I can control the whole environment.
Yeah.
But then I got a phone call from somebody over here at Hampton University.
Well, I think there's a saying, the best laid plans of mice and men or something. I don't know how that actually finishes out, but I know it kind of fits to this story here.
Yeah, it was crazy, man. The dude that was the men's track coach at the time, a guy named David Boyd, he called me. He said, man, I heard you back in town, because he coached at Maryland Eastern Shore once before. Okay. So he knew what the deal was going that went down.
Because we got to remember, this is pre-internet, pre-social. Internet's at a baby at this point, but it's basically pre-internet.
Yeah.
Basically pre-email, pre-social media, pre-cell phone, text messaging. There's a lot of word of mouth that has to happen for people to know who's in town, not in town, etc.
Yeah. But, you know, he said, man, I heard you around. I heard what happened at Maryland Eastern Shore. You need to come over to my house. All right, coach, I don't even know where you live, but give me the address. I went to his house with my homeboy who ran track with Coach Boyd at Maryland Eastern Shore, this guy named Eric Logan, who I love to death. And Coach Boyd was trying to hire Eric Logan at Hampton as his distance coach. And you got to remember, me and Eric worked together, and me and Eric lived together in Maryland. So he said, hey, man, the women's track coach at Hampton University needed an assistant. I said, Coach, man, I'm done with this college thing, man. I'm cool. I'm back in Newport News. I'm not doing that. He said, nah, man, you need to really talk to her before you make a decision. And my man Eric was vouching for me. Eric was like, Coach Boy, he good. This is the guy that needs to be the women's track coach at Hampton. So I had Eric vouching for me and Coach Boy trying to get me to go talk to the lady at Hampton. And the lady at Hampton was the lady named Mamie Rollins, Lord bless her soul.
Yeah,
Mamie Rollins was the women's coach when she left. When she left Ohio State, she came to Hampton.
Yeah,
right. And so I said, all right, I'll go have a conversation with her. And so, because everybody had this rumor that Coach Rollins was hard to deal with, right? She was tough. She was mad at the world. You couldn't work with her. But I went. I met with her. First thing she said, "You want the Laverne Sweat boys." That's my good friend. And she said that you would be a great coach under me. So I go back. I get blessed again because I did right by Coach Sweat.
Uh-huh.
And Coach Sweat always took care of me. She had already laid the foundation and told Coach Rollins about me.
Wow. All
right. And so again, somebody led me to go talk to this lady. And I changed my mind about pursuing a job in the new public school system. And took the job at Hampton University that was paying less than the school system.
Right.
You're talking about also Hampton is a private school.
Right.
Right. And so I got locked back in, and she said the same thing Coach West said. She said, look, I'm busy. I got a lot going on. I'm going to do the administrative work. I'm going to do the compliance work. You go out on the track and train these girls. I got lucky and blessed at the same time again. And then I've been to Hampton ever since.
Dude, I mean, your story is really a reflection on doing right by others. You know, because when you were talking about your time at Norfolk with Coach Sweat, I was waiting for, probably because I feel like this is how I would have done it, which is the wrong way, by the way, of you, let me use the term big timing Coach Sweat, of like, oh, Coach Sweat, you don't know, let me do this, you know, being disrespectful. And
right.
You told the story of like, hey, man, she's been around for a long time and she's the boss, by the way. So I'm going to listen. I'm going to give my ideas. And you didn't say it this way, but what I heard was, and then I earned the respect, Coach Sweat's respect and trust to do the workouts. it could have been really easy for you to dismiss that and be like, oh yeah, that's just what I did. But that ended up, what's the opposite of biting you in the ass? This ended up being a blessing to you as you go to Coach Rollins, legend, by the way, at Hampton, and almost immediately earned her trust because she had a lot of trust in Coach Sweat, and Coach Sweat vouched for you. And so it was like, oh, okay, well, good. Then I can, we can speed along the trust in respect part. I already have a lot of that already because of my connection with Coach Sweat. That's amazing. I mean, really a story of like, treat people with respect regardless, because you never know. By the way, you should do it even if, no matter what, if they become a big part of your life or not. You should do it because we're humans and we should respect and be positive towards each other. But it came back so much better, tenfold positive for you into your Hampton experience, which has now led to, I mean, God bless. I mean, you know, we'll do a quick fast forward and, you know, now you're the head coach director. I mean, that's amazing.
Yeah, man, I've always showed, like I said, I was never like I've never been a jerk or just like a disrespectful kid, young adult or old adult now. So I always respected people who took care of me. Mm-hmm. Like I said, Coach Sweat took care of me, and the foundation I had from my high school coaches and my mother and my uncles and my family, you know, they will never let me be a disrespectful person. Mm-hmm. And so I automatically knew that I had to like be respectful to Coach Sweat. One, she was looking out for me. Two, that was just in me. That's what you're supposed to do.
Right.
And I knew like I'm always a forward thinker. I'm always thinking if I screw this up, you know, it's just going to ruin my name. Right. And I'm not going to be able to, you know, work this coaching thing like I want to. But it came full circle.
That's amazing. So give us a quick speed up, because I want to talk about Hampton, your time at Hampton. You're the assistant women's coach. What's next at Hampton? You stay at Hampton this whole time, right? There's no sneakaways come back, right? Yeah. So you're the women's you're the women's assistant coach. What comes next as a role there at Hampton?
I was the women's assistant coach for 3 years, and Coach Rollins left, and they turned the program over to me. So I became the head women's coach for 10 years.
Yep.
In between those 10 years, I was also the interim men's track coach on two occasions.
Okay.
Right? They kept trying to get me to do both programs, but the money won't add up. Right? So, and then I became, 10 years later, I became the director of all the programs. So I went from assistant women's coach, the head women's coach, the interim men's coach, to now director of programs.
So how many years total now at Hampton?
25 years. They gave me an award last fall. They said, you're in the quarter century club. I said, Jesus Christ.
You're not that old. How's that happen?
I was 52 years old.
The
guy said, you know what? That means you've been coaching half the time you've been listening.
Yeah. You know, that's quite amazing. It in the culture of NCAA track and field, and maybe NCAA Division I track and field. It's, by the way, I'm that guy. 10 years of coaching, I was at five different institutions. So it's very, hoppy, move around. And no begrudging, by the way, if you are making more money at the next place, go for it. We don't pay coaches enough anyway.
No.
So bless all to that. It's rare. I don't think it's getting rarer. I don't want to over-exaggerate it, but it's rare that we see a coach at one institution for 25 years. If I were to try to name them off the top of my head, I could probably get to 10 pretty quick, and then I fall off. And I know there's more, but, it's easier to say, oh, yeah, this guy's been here 5 years, this guy's been here 2 years, et cetera, et cetera. What has you've been successful throughout your entire 25 years there. You've continued to gain experience, as you gain experience as a head coach and now as a director. There's no doubt other opportunities have come across your desk. What has kept you at Hampton for 25 years? And nothing in the future that would tell us that you're not going to be there for another 25 years. What is it about Hampton?
Well, Hampton is a great place. The administration here, has always been good to me. The past administration and now the new administration. So I always had everything I needed to be successful here in Hampton. And I've always known that Hampton was a great place, right? One of the upper echelons of historically black colleges and universities. So I always knew, you know, as long as I kept recruiting good kids and had great assistant coaches and did right by people, that I could always be successful here. Then also, you know, I didn't want to be a job hopper. As a young coach, you know, I figured let me stay a little bit longer because I didn't want to get the label as this job hopper, and I didn't want that to affect my daughters by just hopping all over the place. So that's what happened, and then I had so much success here that the 25 years went fast. Like I tell people, if you're not having success, then the years go slow.
Oh, that's a good point.
So because we had so much success, you know, stuff stopped moving real fast. But also, Mike, on a personal note, like I never got the call, and I mean the call from other institutions. One, I don't know why, is still like hesitant about hiring an HBCU guy as the head coach at a major institution. And I've interviewed for 10 of them, right? We, you know, offline, we could talk about it. So I've done the interviews, but I can't get that athletic director in his mind to say, I'm going to hire an HBCU guy as my head track coach, even though my resume outweighs the person that they hire. That person just has the name on their paper with my resume. And they tell me, they call me back with these conversations. Oh, man, you're an outstanding candidate. You're a top guy. You know, the bluff stuff. But I never got the call. And so that's personal to me because I know my coaching ability. I know my successes. And I know what I can do on a bigger stage. Because I've already done it at a small school. I've done it at the big stage, but being at a small school.
Right.
And then also, you know, I got a lot of friends that are head coaches at major, major schools. And we've never really had the conversation about me at least even joining their staff to project me to the next big Power Five school. Because you know it's always a step. You got to go here to go there. If you can't, just go straight there. So I've always been one type of guys, you know, I don't get caught up in all that. You know, I just lock in and try to outcoach the next person. And I say, well, you know what? If I can't get to where I want to be, I'm going to be at the same NCAA championship with everybody else. Right. Well, I'm going to be at the same Olympic Games with everybody else. So they're going to continue to know Maurice Pierce. But the university has been good to me. I've always had support, Mike. And on a personal note, I just never got the call.
You know, at this age and stage where I'm at, I get to talk to athletes a lot, especially the high school athletes when it comes to recruiting. You know, the years that I was a college coach, I recruiting was a big deal for me. And so now recruiting's a big deal to me differently though, because I really love that track the sport and track the coaches, give kids an opportunity to go to college that they wouldn't necessarily have had the opportunity to go to college, or at least make it cheaper for them with scholarship based on their athletic ability. And I don't think it's a recent thing. I think we like to frame it as a recent thing, the D1 or bust, the Power Five or bust type mentality. I think that's been since since the 1980s. Maybe, you know, TV and social media has made it, you know, a kid in Washington can grow up a Florida State fan, if you will, easier today than they could back in the 80s. But Florida State was still on TV. They were still Power Five. You know, we didn't call it back then. But I really like to advise young athletes, you know, high school athletes about that. You know, there are good coaches at all levels, NAIA, junior college, D3, D2, HBCU, Division I, et cetera, to really do your homework on that.
Yeah.
And to me, stability is a key factor of that. I mean, Maurice, if you're the greatest coach in the world, and we're going to talk about some of the stuff that you've done there, because, you know, we have to answer the question. You said, if I can't make it to the Olympics as an athlete, well, then I'm going to coach athletes to the Olympics. So we got to touch on that, of course. yeah. But to me, you know, if I'm advising a kid to go run for Maurice Pierce, but and you're the greatest coach in the world, but you're gone in a year, well, that hasn't done anything for the kid. You know, even if they transfer with you, that's still a whole thing, right? So stability is a very important part. That's what I've loved about, you know, kind of from afar, your story is the stability component and the continuity of success. You know, it's not like, oh, one year you have a good team or a good athlete and, you know, 10 years goes by. You've been very consistent with the results. So that's what I've always just kind of, you know, admired from afar. So tell us, you know, I wrote this down because I love this quote. You said, you know, if I can't run at the Olympics as an athlete, then I'm going to coach athletes to the Olympics. Well, did that pan out? Tell us about, I know the answer to that, but, you know, not everybody does. I'd like to know, how'd that pan out?
Well, it panned out great. You know, I've had somebody on every Olympic except from 2000 to the last Olympics. I had somebody on the team.
Is that right? I didn't know that. Wow.
Yeah. Actually, I had somebody in 96. They had a girl who ran for the Virgin Islands, who I was one of when I was assistant at Norfolk State.
Yeah.
But me personally, in 2000 and 2004, I had James Carter.
Oh, friend. Yeah, I love him.
And the 400 meter. Yeah, James, great guy.
I actually love that dude. Like, he gets a bad rap because of some of the things that happened at the Olympics and stuff. But
yeah,
he is, and he's doing a great job with his club and stuff, man.
Right.
I love that dude. I'm that's so cool that you coached him. I'm a big fan of James Carter. That's cool.
James, like I said, James. You know, me and James had some issues, but, you know, that's growing pains. Mm-hmm. But James is a phenomenal coach. James is extremely knowledgeable of the sport.
Passionate.
People might say he rubbed in the wrong way, but that's his personality versus your personality.
Right. That's right. I would say but
But he knows what he's talking about.
Yeah, yeah. Love him.
And so that was 2000 to 2004.
Right.
2008, I had David Payne. And the 110 hurdles got a silver medal.
That's right. Wow. Holy cow.
Yeah. Then, you know, 12 and 16, I had Francina for Corey.
That's right. Yeah.
In between that time, I coached Kelly Wells.
Yeah.
Before she went down there with Dennis Mitchell. And Dennis did a great job with her. And she got the medal in 2012.
Yep. Good friend. Yeah.
I coached Michael Tinsley in between that time.
Wow.
Rachel Boone was on the world championship team. You know, so I've had somebody, like I said, on every world championship or Olympic team from 2000 up until the last world championship and Olympics. So all the way up to like 17.
What's the difference? You know, I think if you were to ask every track coach, I think it might be 100%. There's not many questions you can ask anybody that would be 100% the same answer. I think if you asked every coach, do you want to coach an Olympian? They would all say yes, but they don't know what that involves. It is different. I've worked with a couple of guys. I will never say I coached them towards their Olympics. I did coach Trey Hardy for a little while. I certainly did not get him to the Olympics. You know, I was a very small part of his journey. I've worked with Justin Gatlin, you know, one of my very good friends, but I certainly wouldn't say I coached, you know. Other guys did an amazing job with those guys.
Yeah.
I'm a small part of their journeys. You're actively coaching these people, so you're a big part of their journeys. What is the difference when you think about someone that came onto your team as a freshman or a transfer, and they were good? They're not coming to your team if they're not good. They weren't Olympians when they came to you, but you coached through them up to Olympics. And what it takes to not only make the Olympics, but then make finals and then medal. Those are all different brackets at that level.
Mm-hmm.
What's it like? What's the difference? What's the difference as the coach? And I don't mean the X's and O's. We know that, you know, intensity gets higher and recovery probably gets bigger and things like that. We won't get into that. But mentality wise, how do you help a kid? It's different. I have to imagine it's different having a kid go through indoor and trying to get ready for conference and nationals, and then outdoor, get through Texas Relay, whatever, all the meets you go to, conference.
Oh, yeah.
That's different than, hey, we are singularly focused on your Olympic trials and then singularly focused on your Olympic races. Tell us, kind of help us out. Is it easy? Not is it easy, because I know it's not easy. Are there a lot of stressful parts to it? Is it easy? Maybe it is easy. I don't know. I've never been there. Help us understand that aspect.
Well, it's two parts, because the most stressful thing for an Olympian, especially in America, is first the Olympic trials.
The trials, right.
Because, you know, the Olympic trials is probably
to kill
one
it.
Scale below harder than the Olympic Games.
Yeah.
Right. So what has to happen is it's extremely hard, and the coach and the athlete have to turn the world off for a whole year.
What do you mean by that?
Like, any and everything that you like to do or wanted to do in your social life or just regular life.
Got it.
Like, you got to be so locked in that you don't even know what comes on TV or what time shows come on.
Mm.
So you got to turn the world off for a whole year. Because if you don't, you got to wait 4 more years.
Right.
Right? So I tell everybody, you got to, like, completely turn the world in off, and you have to be extremely locked in. As I got to be locked in. And whatever I ask you to do, I got to do the same thing. So if I ask you to turn the world off, I got to turn the world off. Because while you're resting, I got to still be resting too. Because I got to be in shape to be on that track with you all day long. I got to be in shape to travel with you around the world, right? And if I'm not mentally sharp and physically sharp, I can't train you to the best of the ability. So the coach, the athlete, both have to turn it off because the season is longer, one, like you said, because the athlete's not competing every weekend.
Right.
You're not competing till late. So you have to have an extremely abundant amount of patience and time management skills. Because everything is time management, right? Like, you got to, both persons got to, like, we got to go to the weight room at the same time. We got to be on the track at the same time. I got to go with you when you get your physio work. You know, I got to make sure you're eating properly. I got to make sure you're resting properly. While I'm monitoring all of this stuff, I got to do the same thing. I got two jobs to do. I got to take care of me. Mm-hmm. I got to take care of you.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So it's probably the hardest, most individual coaching job of any sport in the world. And so what you're trying to do, like you said, and the people I had, they either made the finals or got a medal at the Olympic Games. So I didn't have people that just, like, barely made the team. These were high profile people, topped in the world.
Which is amazing in itself, by the way, just making the team. I mean, let's be real here. Yeah. We're talking about 1% of the 1% of the 1% here. Yeah.
Right. That's it. There's 1% of the world. And also at the same time, I got just as much pressure on me as the athlete. Because if I screw it up, all eyes come back to the coach.
Mm-hmm.
They can say that, well, the athlete had a bad day and all kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Which athletes do. We've had enough athletes to have bad days. Mm-hmm. Just so happen to have a bad day at the Olympic Games. But that conversation comes back to the coach.
Mm-hmm.
So now you're talking about contracts and shoe deals and all that stuff. And can the coach get you ready? And can he continue this? All right. So you got to turn the world off.
How do you, you know, it's one thing. It's extremely special if you coach one athlete to the Olympic Games. I mean, that literally, that puts you in an extremely small club in coaching. You have done it consistently while at the same time consistently putting a good product on the track for Hampton. How do you balance? Oh, and by the way, we're not even also talking about personal life, relationships, children, maybe your own passions and charities. You know, you do have a life. You are Maurice first, not Coach Pierce. That can be hard sometimes, by the way. I realize that as well.
Yeah.
How do you, I don't even want to say balance, because I'm not sure, like, I don't like using the term work-life balance, because I'm not sure there is a balance. How do you handle all of those responsibilities and do them at a high level?
Wow. Discipline.
Hmm.
I'm not successful if I don't have the self-discipline.
Because
you're right. I'm continuing to raise the bar and keep the standard of my college program. I got a family. I got getting people for the Olympic Games. So you got to have family support also. So I've always had great family support and great friend support. So all of my friends have always supported me and pushed me to be good. They know that I can't go hang out or I can't travel to this place or go to this event. They say, oh, he's coaching. Well, that's what he's supposed to be doing.
Right.
So I've always had people continue to push me and understand that Maurice Pierce is zoned in to this track thing. And Maurice Pierce just is getting people to the highest level. So a lot of stuff that I wasn't able to do over 25 years, I couldn't do it on a big stage. I did it on a small stage. like I still have like social stuff I do. I'm on the board of directors at the Boys Club. I'm a fraternity man.
So that's I still amazing got to me.
Yeah. So I still got, you know, things that I do in between that helps me with my balance.
Yeah.
But I just don't spend a lot of time like with foolish stuff.
Yeah.
And so over 25 years I haven't wasted time.
You have to be, you use that word discipline. You have to be judicious in where you spend your time.
Yes.
Because you have
I can't afford to waste time.
Yeah.
Right. Because just wasting time means that you might have lost out on a great conversation with a potential recruit, or you got late to the track.
Right.
Or you adjusted the track workout in which you shouldn't have because you weren't well rested because you wasted time doing something else. So I just can't waste. I'm not good at wasting time.
I love that you're on the board of director for the Boys and Girls Club. You know, and I think this is, you know, I'm a huge social media advocate, but I think this is where maybe social media, here's where I do see a negative. In social media, it's easy to think that Maurice Pierce is just a track coach. And I don't mean just in a negative way, like, oh, we know how much time, like, oh, and by the way, oh, he's probably a family guy. You know, he probably has family. Okay. But that's it. And it's like, oh, you know what? Maurice is a neighbor. You've got neighbors. Maybe you have a passion. You love to bowl. So you're in a bowling league. I'm trying to think, you know, that'd be Mouse, by the way. I'm trying to think, you know, like, oh, it's not just your job, which is the way it should be, by the way. You should be a neighbor, be on a board of the Boys and Girls Club, donate your time here, go to church there. You know, that's the way it should be. But it's very easy to be very, I think the word's myopic, to just think, oh, all he does is coach. So why didn't those kids do well? That's all he's got to do is coach. And it's like, oh man, I've got a sick kid at home. I've got a board meeting that I got to prepare for because we're getting ready to raise money for this facility. You know, like there is 1,000 things going on here. Mm-hmm. And yes, track is one of them. But at the end of the day, I have to say that, you know, and I'm track guy all the way through 100% here. It is just track. The performances are just track. The kids that you're affecting positively, the kids that you're affecting through that Boys and Girls Club, your neighborhood, the neighborhood kids, things like that. That's where real life and enrichment legacy occurs. Unfortunately, we're going to more think of your legacy as, well, how many Olympians did he coach? What's his school records look like? You know, those kind of things. And really those are, I don't want to say superficial because I don't want to take away from their specialness, but there's so much more to it. It's amazing to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, man. Whatever I'm doing, something that's not coaching related, is taken away, but it's positive.
Right.
So I'm not wasting time. I'm using the extra time I have for something positive, whether it's church related, Boys and Girls Club, fraternity related. Or just spending time with family, or you know, occasionally finding time just to go to a happy hour with some high school friends. You know, my biggest thing is in the fall time, I get a kick out of just hanging out with my old high school friends, going to high school football games.
Yeah,
because in the fall time, I don't travel as much.
Right. Hey, speaking of that,
so that's my outlet.
I would be remiss if I didn't add, we're running out of time, so we're going to start wrapping it up here. But the other day so I think we're connected on Facebook, not Twitter. You're not a Twitter guy, right? You're a Facebook guy, if I remember correctly.
Right.
I get them mixed up sometimes. I'm like, oh yeah, I saw that post. I don't remember where it was, but I know it was on somewhere. I believe it was AI. Allen Iverson just got a street or something named after him. And you were there. Are you boys with AI, or is it just because the Newport News crew?
No, that's my guy. I've been knowing Alan. What we call is him that? Chuck. I've been knowing Chuck since we were young. He lived in the same apartment complex as my grandmother.
Is that right?
We was young. It's like a 3-age gap. And one of his close friends growing up was one of my best friends in high school, right? A guy named Lamont. So we've always known each other, and throughout like rec league sports, he was a phenomenal athlete.
Yeah.
So we've always like had intermediate friends.
Yeah.
Like my boy Lamont was his friend, and he was also my friend. I knew him when he was little, living out, you know, certain neighborhoods.
Yeah.
And so there's always been a respect level. I see him as a respect level. He see me as a respect level because we've known each other for years. That's so cool. It wasn't just an impromptu of Maurice Pierce jumping in the picture.
Yeah, that's what I thought. I was like, oh, right, you know, right. And that wouldn't be, nah. You know, no judgment. I'd be like, oh, yeah. Man, he's cool. I'd love to get a picture with AI too, you know? So I was like, oh, do you know him? Or just like, oh, it's Newport News and we're part of the same culture. No, you knew him. That's so cool, man.
Yeah.
Okay,
that's my guy. Then
my fun question is, and I can't remember if he did track or not. Did he do track? I know he's an excellent football. He was a quarterback, if I remember, and receiver, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
Obviously, basketball. What track event would have been his best track event?
Jesus Christ.
I mean, because dude was an athlete.
Probably, this is crazy, but probably 200 meters and triple jump.
Yeah. Okay. Because of the coordination and athleticism.
Yeah. He's like 6 feet tall. He's real fast, but he got a long gait. So he could probably be a good triple jumper. Yeah. And he can easily flow through a 200.
Yeah. Dude was such an athlete. You know, the answer might be any event he wanted. Because, I know we know him as an excellent basketball player, but I know I've seen highlight tapes of his football. I mean, dude could have went somewhere for football, for crying out loud. He was amazing.
Oh, he wanted to play football. He could have played in the NFL.
Oh, dude.
That's amazing. He was that good in football.
Yeah. He was smart, though. He went basketball.
Yeah.
That's smart. You got the choice.
Right.
Basketball. Right. Long life is much better than basketball, I'm imagining. Wrap us up here today, Coach. You know, 25 years, you've seen Hampton where it was 25 years ago to where it is today. You always have a plan. So you always kind of, that means you always have kind of an eye, a vision for the future, 1 year, 5 year, 10 years. What's got you excited about Hampton right now? What are you looking most forward to the next 3, 4, 5 years at Hampton?
I'm excited because one, Hampton, we're in a new conference this year. Well, we've been in there for like last 2 years. It's the CAA conference. So it's a new challenge. You know, I won a lot of championships in the MEAC. I won championships in the Big South Conference.
Right.
And we should have won the championship our first year in the CAA last year. But I'm excited about the possibility of starting a new legacy of winning success in this new conference. So that's driving me right now. That's driving me with my assistant coaches. That's driving me with recruiting because I want to win.
Yeah.
I always want to win championships. I want to win in this new conference. And so I'm excited about it, and we're recruiting to be able to be successful in this conference. And I just don't want to be – I don't want to live on history and be like, well, he got a lot of championships. He's good. No, I want to keep on winning. And so that's why I'm excited about this new chapter and the new conference. And then we got phenomenal athletes. We had a guy who was All-American indoor in 800, Leo Davis. So we got phenomenal athletes that can still compete at the national stage. But I'm excited about the new chapter and the new conference and the new university because we got a new administrator here. Second year, new president, President Daryl K. Williams, a retired 3-star general.
Wow!
So I'm excited about I'm excited about everything that's moving forward with the university.
I love it, man. You know, you have certainly, I love how you said that because, you know, I want to lead with, you know, you've certainly created a legacy there. But what I hear you say is, yeah, that's cool, but the story's still going. I'm not done. This ain't the last chapter. This is just a chapter of this, man.
Yeah.
So I love that competitiveness. I love that leadership that you have of like, all right, new conference. Well, that means we're going to do some things differently, whether that's recruit differently, et cetera, then that's what we're going to do. You're continually, even at 25 years at the same university, you're still adapting and improving yourself and your program, man. I love hearing that.
Yeah, man. That's what it's all about. I got to keep growing and keep going.
Keep growing and keep going. I love it. And always have a plan.
Yeah, man. Maurice Pierce is always going to have a plan.
Always have a plan. I love it. I love it. Well, Maurice, man, again, thank you so much. You know, I know how busy you are. You're getting tons. You're getting blown up on your cell phone and stuff, man. It's been an absolute joy to learn your story, man. I really love the themes of, you know, we didn't actually say these words here, but I love this this theme of home and culture for you. I think I knew you were from the area, but I didn't know if there was like, oh, you went, you know, to LA for 5 years or something. So I love that, you know, you said earlier, you can always go home. And I love that you have home. I love that you're creating home. You're creating home for athletes as well as yourself and your family. I just really think that, you know, at your heart, at your core, that's a really important thing. And I think that's why you have been at an institution for 25 years and you've been successful at that institution for 25 years because you've made it home. And I think that's an extremely important thing.
I made it home because the university sits in my home. You know, people say 757. That's a hashtag now. 757. I'm 757.
I have no doubts about that. I'm please don't pull up your shirt and show the tattoo. We'll just leave it at that.
No, I'm 757 all day.
That's no doubt. No doubt. All right, my friend, thank you so much. I really am grateful. I think, you know, I love spotlighting the journeys of coaches. And I think, you know, you've been on my list for a while. We nailed it. I think people are listening to this and understanding, you know, a different route to taking coaching. Every route's differently. And I love your story and your journey. And I think it's going to help provide inspiration and knowledge to a lot of people listening, man. So thank you so much for sharing with us.
Hey, Mike, I appreciate it. I'm glad we worked it out.
Absolutely. And thank you for being here and listening. I really am grateful. I'm just always floored with these coaches that come here. Not only, first of all, just for the time. I mean, think about it. It's about a 2-hour commitment to be here with me, of all people. So always grateful for time during track season. You know, he just got off of indoor season with an All-American, which that's the toughest thing in the world, indoor season. Now he's staring ahead at a new conference and nationals. And I'm just always just humbled and just love learning from their story. So thank you, Brees, for being here today. Thank you guys for listening. Join us next week. We'll do it all over again. Have a great one, everybody.
If it goes to appreciate the coach, the ones who point people most. Every season needs a voice of reason, speaking the growth. Got a bat for you, carry the load. It's coffee to the soul for those of us who stay on the go. Proper handoff to stay in the zone. What you packing for the road? There's more than one way to the goal. Take notes, that's paying your toll. It ain't practice if your purpose ain't clear. It can't happen till you listen with both ears. You can't mentor without a mentor's years of experience. You can reinvent those years. Every plan's got a standard to live up to. And the price sacrifice, can you give up you? It's a choice and a fight, not a win or lose. It's not a ploy, but advice so y'all can make more moves. It's not about how to, it's all about why. You don't know till you know who you are inside. 6 million ways to tie, choose none. So we all cross the finish line, the work ain't done. So we learn from the experts, we all gotta put in the legwork. Gill Athletics is a network, it's all about connections. Put together for the profession, so every track coach can be blessed.